a regular, a well-respected reporter, Bob Considine. Bob?
This is Bob Considine en route to Dallas. The President of the United States is dead from a senseless assassin's bullet. The first president born in this century, the first of the Roman Catholic faith, is now one with McKinley, Garfield, and Lincoln. The oldest adage of the sorrowing Secret Service, that there's just no way to ensure that some nut won't step up and kill the president, has been tragically confirmed. President Lyndon Johnson faces the same imponderable whims of those who may approach him as a friend and kill him as an enemy. Some will say that the late president should not have mingled so openly with crowds that could not be screened and approved of in advance. That, of course, is lamentably impossible. Presidents and ordinary people, too, assume that there is no criminal violence in strangers around them, particularly in a congregation such as with greeting and waving to the chief executive. None of us will likely forget what we personally were doing at the time the shot was fired. Americans associate themselves with their presidents, particularly one who was as buoyant and full of life as John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Personally, I was flying from New York to Chicago en route to Omaha to speak there tonight, speak at a dinner being bestowed on 12 Midwest governors, including a man whose name now looms larger on the political scene because of this tragic death, Michigan's Governor George Romney. I just finished reading a piece in Time magazine describing the late president's trip to New York last week. I quote a portion of the article. It goes, Mr. Kennedy aged his Secret Service detail 10 years by foregoing the usual motorcycle escort into the city. At one of 10 midtown traffic lights that stopped the presidential limousine, an ambitious female camera bug rushed up and fired a flashbulb at Kennedy's side of the car. A New York police official moaned, she might well have been an assassin. As for the purpose of the president's stop-and-go entrance into New York, Time magazine continues, the official explanation was that he wanted no fuss and feathers. It could only be presumed that Kennedy was zeroing in on the safe motorist's boat. End of the Time magazine quote. I had hardly finished reading that piece when the pilot's voice filled the United airliner. Ladies and gentlemen, he said from the cockpit, there has been an unconfirmed report, and I repeat, unconfirmed, that President Kennedy has been assassinated. Several passengers took out their rosaries. Most fell silent, but a man in the acoustical rear of the jet kept talking to a hostess about some wholly irreverent and irrelevant matter, and continued to talk when the pilot confirmed the report with the added information that the president was still alive. I jumped off the plane at Chicago. There was just time to get a bag off the plane and head for American Airlines flight to Dallas. They've sent for the priest, my Washington editor, Milt Kaplan, had told me over the phone. A few minutes later, as I sped past one of the newsstands at O'Hare Terminal, there was a radio playing. A somber crowd stood in front of it. I couldn't hear what the commentator was saying, but suddenly he stopped talking, and his voice was suddenly and terribly replaced by the national anthem. That was enough to tell me. I never heard it played more sadly. This is Bob Considine en route to Dallas.
This is Don Gardner again in the ABC radio newsroom in New York. A cable from our ABC correspondent received just moments ago from Amsterdam. Ernest de Haas, who cables in the heart of the capital of Holland, the people mourn for the President of the United States. And further reaction from a grieved and stunned nation. All throughout the country, people are still trying to recover, still trying to believe, did this happen? It did. President Johnson, now at the White House, presently, together with members of his cabinet. Then there are meetings later with members of both sides of the political fence on Capitol Hill. President Johnson taking over the reins of government to make sure that things are secure in the legislative, in the defense, in all departments of the government. Out in Washington State, an observation from our correspondent, Byron Johnson of ABC affiliate, KOMO in Seattle.
Governor Rossellini of the state of Washington has this reaction to today's tragic news of President Kennedy's assassination. One of tremendous Speaker of the Washington State House of Representatives, William S. Day of Spokane, termed the fatal shooting almost unbelievable. He added, "We may have to keep people, such as the President of the United States, from participating in public events to protect those who make the sacrifice of public service." The governor was asked if he thought it was becoming increasingly dangerous to hold public office. Rosalini answered,
"I don't think it's becoming more dangerous, no, but I think that you can never take complete precautions. We must take all precautions possible, but you can never take complete precautions because, as is indicated in this instance, with a full Secret Service guard around the president, if somebody wants to do something like this, even as the president himself declared some months back, it can be done."
Brian Johnson, ABC affiliate, KLMO, Seattle.
And here, back in the ABC radio newsroom in New York, virtually every corner of the world is in mourning tonight over the assassination of President Kennedy. In Moscow, the radio commentators announced the president's death in mournful tones. The Moscow radio described the late president as an outstanding American statesman. It was near midnight in Moscow when the news of the president's assassination came in. Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko telephoned U.S. Ambassador Foy Koehler at the U.S. Embassy to express his, and I quote, "shock and greatest sympathy to the American people." Gromyko said that official condolences will be conveyed later at the very highest level. He presumably was referring to a message coming in shortly from Premier Khrushchev. In Vatican City, Pope Paul VI said he prays that the sacrifice of President Kennedy will serve the cause of the peace of the world. Then he reflected upon the sad task of Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy to have to inform her children, the loss of their father. From London, Sir Winston Churchill said tonight that the assassination of the president is a monstrous act which has taken from us a great statesman and a wise and valiant man. "Those who come after Mr. Kennedy," said Sir Winston, "must strive the more to achieve the ideals of world peace and human happiness and dignity to which President Kennedy was dedicated." Other messages of condolence are arriving in Washington tonight from all parts of the world. As President Lyndon Johnson arrived in Washington at Andrews Air Force Base on a sad return from Dallas, Texas, Mr. Johnson said this, "It is a sad time for all people. We have suffered a loss that cannot be weighed. For me, it is a deep personal tragedy. I know the world shares the sorrow that Mrs. Kennedy and her family bear. I will do my best. This is all that I can do. I ask your help and God's." As President Johnson sworn in to the office, the highest office of the land, sworn in at Love Airport in Dallas, Texas today by a federal judge, as he was saying that message to the country, Mrs. Kennedy was escorting the body of her president to Bethesda Naval Hospital. There, the body to be prepared for its viewing tomorrow in the White House and undoubtedly on Sunday by the public in the great rotunda of the nation's capital. A sadness goes over the entire nation. A stunning sadness it's hard to recover from. But observations upon the scene and what has happened today and what will be maybe our future in this country, those observations from one of the most respected men of the ABC News staff, Edward P. Morgan. Here is Ed Morgan in Washington.
Good evening. Here is the shape of the news. Before breakfast in Fort Worth, Texas this morning, a steady rain pelted the asphalt parking lot outside the hotel where President and Mrs. John F. Kennedy had spent the night. Without a raincoat, hat, or umbrella, as usual, the president strode out into the downpour, walked briskly around a wooden barricade, shaking hands with everybody in reach. He then mounted a temporary platform, was greeted with thunderous applause when he told his soaked audience there were no faint hearts among those who had turned out to stand, some of them for hours, in the early morning rainfall. The crowd laughed when the president explained that his wife was still organizing herself. "It takes a little longer for her in the morning," he quipped, "but she looks better than we do when she is finished." In the crowd of some 5,000, one anti-Kennedy placard was spotted. Inside the hotel, more than 2,000 persons attended a breakfast in the ballroom sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce of Fort Worth. The president obviously relished the moment when Jacqueline Kennedy made her breathtaking appearance, radiating smiles, dressed in a stunning pink suit. They gave her a standing ovation, then listened intently while the president defended the enormous money and energy expended for national defense. No one expects our life will be easy in this decade, or perhaps in this century, the president declared at breakfast time. Before noon, the president and his party had made the short hop by air to Dallas, where the glowering skies that darkened Fort Worth began to lift a little. The president and Mrs. Kennedy, Texas Governor John Connally and his wife, rode in one of those enormous, expensive convertible limousines that the White House has ready wherever the chief executive travels. On their way to the Dallas Trade Mart, the motorcade passed through the city along streets lined with tens of thousands of cheering Texans. Reporters had to look hard to find anti-Kennedy signs. There were a very few. It was 12:30 p.m. Dallas Central Time, and the motorcade was nearing its destination. As the limousine approached a triple underpass, three bursts of gunfire pierced the air. An observer remembered that the president was waving at the moment, then at that awful look crossed his face. He slumped forward over the seat. Mrs. Kennedy screamed. Governor Connally also fell wounded in the chest. Jacqueline Kennedy cradled her husband's head, bleeding profusely from the wounds, cradled it in her arms. Oh, no, she kept crying as the limousine sped, siren screaming, to the nearest hospital several miles away. Utter confusion and pandemonium reigned outside the emergency room of the hospital. Inside, 10 surgeons struggled to save the life of the 46-year-old president in the prime of his life, the youngest man ever elected to the White House. Surgeons performed a tracheotomy, an incision into the windpipe in effort to facilitate breathing. He received blood transfusions, but the president was unconscious when he arrived at the hospital, and physicians knew almost at a glance that he was dying. Two priests gave him the last rites of the Roman Catholic Church, and leaving the emergency room, they confirmed what had been rumored almost from the moment the first shot rang out. The president was dead. Barely a half hour had elapsed. When John F. Kennedy perished, Lyndon B. Johnson became the 36th president of the United States. At the very moment of the assassination, Johnson was riding several cars behind the president's limousine in the motorcade. His car also sped to the hospital, and Johnson was placed under sedation, his physicians fearful that the president's death might place an unbearable strain on his heart. He had had a massive heart attack in the summer of 1955. An hour after Mr. Kennedy succumbed, however, Johnson accompanied the body on the flight back to Washington. Before the presidential jet was airborne, Federal District Judge Sarah Hughes administered the oath of office to Johnson in the forward compartment of the plane. Mrs. Kennedy stood to his right, her stockings spattered with her late husband's blood. Mrs. Johnson stood to his right as he repeated, "I do solemnly swear that I will perform the duties of the President of the United States to the best of my ability and defend, protect, and preserve the Constitution of the United States." Afterward, President Johnson grimly said, "Okay, let's get this plane back to Washington." The Capitol was stunned. Reaction ranged from unprintable anger to numb silence. This reporter, by coincidence, was having lunch with Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota, the Democratic whip in the Senate. When I reported to him the news, he was speechless. From abroad, the messages pour in. Sir Winston Churchill said, "The assassination was a monstrous act that has taken from us a great statesman and a wise and valiant man." Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko immediately called the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, said he was shocked that Premier Khrushchev was preparing himself a full message of sympathy. Republican senators adopted a unanimous resolution, saying Mr. Kennedy gave the world the benefit of his prudence, his experience, his courage, and his leadership. In statements to Mrs. Kennedy and President Johnson, AFL-CIO President Meany said no words can express our shock and grief, and pledged Mr. Johnson the Federation's full backing. Trifling as it may seem, there was, of course, other news today. Buoyed by another by-election victory, British Labourites are taunting Prime Minister Macmillan to call a general election. Japan's pro-Western Premier Ikeda won an overwhelming mandate to run his nation for another 4 years. French President de Gaulle and German Chancellor Erhard pledged an all-out effort to settle their quarrels over farm prices that threatened to disrupt the European common market. Erhard was due in Washington over the weekend for conferences with President Kennedy. What happens to his trip is up in the air. Five top commanders of the Indian Armed Forces were killed in a helicopter crash. At the UN, the 17 participating nations agreed to resume disarmament negotiations at Geneva. The Vatican's Ecumenical Council gave its approval to a historic document on liturgy that will allow modern languages to replace Latin in many Roman Catholic ceremonies. In Dallas tonight, police are questioning a 24-year-old man named Lee Oswald, a one-time defector to Russia who is chairman of a Fair Play for Cuba committee, so-called. Oswald was also held in the slaying of a Dallas policeman who charged into a theater after a fleeing suspect shortly after the president's assassination. Oswald was carried kicking and screaming from the theater, but so far he has not been charged with the crime, may in fact be the wrong man. Oswald lived for several years in the Soviet Union, married a Russian woman, but returned to the U.S. last fall, apparently disillusioned with life under communism. Whoever did kill John F. Kennedy apparently hid in an upper story of a textbook storage warehouse, commanding an unobstructed view of the presidential cavalcade. Police found a high-powered rifle with telescopic sights in the room, empty shells, and food litter, which indicated the murderer had lain in wait for some time. Shortly after 6 tonight in Washington, the big Air Force jet that had carried President Kennedy on so many of his journeys, A-1, it was Air Force One, it was called, touched down at Andrews Air Force Base in suburban Maryland. Pallbearers of all military services went aboard. Among those helping to carry out the bronze casket was Larry O'Brien, the president's close friend and legislative strategist. In his first public statement as president, Lyndon Johnson said, "We have suffered a loss that cannot be weighed. I will do my best. That is all I can do. I ask."